This is Fresh Air. Susan Trento describes her new book as an investigation into what Washington has become. More specifically, she's looking at the selling of access and influence in Washington. Her new book, The Powerhouse, focuses on Robert Keith Gray, who just stepped down last week as head of the Washington office of Hill & Knowlton, a powerful PR company with a controversial roster of clients. She says Gray wrote the book on international public relations. His company's clients have included the Communist Government of Angola, the BCCI, the Reverend Sun Myung-moon, and China after Tiananmen Square. Gray has had close connections with Presidents Reagan and Bush. In 1980, he co-chaired Reagan's inaugural committee. Trento says PR experts like Gray use their political connections to lure clients. Just before the Gulf War, Hill & Knowlton took on Kuwait as a client and promoted the group Citizens for a Free Kuwait. I asked Trento what the company did for Kuwait.
It was a massive campaign. A large public relations account might be $1 million a year. The government of Kuwait funneled in over $10 million in just a few months. So it was an enormous amount of money, and a large effort was made to try to encourage the American public to support war against Iraq. They did it by taking a poll to find out what the American people believed, what would make them angry enough, what were the buttons to push to make them really want to fight Saddam Hussein, and it was atrocities. So they provided video press releases, radio shows, congressional hearings, and they would produce as many atrocities as they could, some of them legitimate. Obviously, there were atrocities, but others were later questioned as being manufactured.
Was Citizens for a Free Kuwait formed or named by the public relations company that represented it?
Right. That was the name made up by Hill & Knowlton. And actually, if you look at the registration forms, the first name was Committee for a Free Kuwait, but I guess that didn't sound as good as Citizens.
So what was the difference between what that group appeared to be and what it actually was?
Well, it appeared to be, this spontaneous group of citizens who were coming forward to try to, in support of Kuwait, to try to encourage the American public to support those issues. You know, in reality, it was a very well-financed campaign paid for by the government of Kuwait that, in effect, drowns out our debate that we should have in this country when we're facing something like war, so that instead of having like spontaneous demonstrations for peace or for war or whatever, you know, you had these very well orchestrated campaigns where people would be told when and where to show up, and they would all have on color coordinated T-shirts and balloons, and it was paid for and organized and staged events that weren't really real.
How do you think Citizens for a Free Kuwait misled the American public?
Well, you know, in the case of Naira, who was first 2020 and 60 Minutes and others have reported on this before, but Naira was a 15-year-old teary-eyed girl that Hill & Knowlton put before a committee on Capitol Hill that was holding hearings at the time. It was a human rights committee holding hearings at the time before the war, and she testified. It was stated that she had just fled from Kuwait, that they could not identify who she was for fear of her family in Kuwait, and she testified very movingly that she had witnessed hundreds of babies being ripped from their incubators so that the Iraqis could take the incubators back to Baghdad, and these babies were left on the floor to die. It was very moving. It was very emotional and horrifying. Even Amnesty International believed it, and the president himself made references to this atrocity. after the war, when reporters went into Kuwait to try to verify this story, they were unable to do so. The human rights groups were unable to do so. And that led many to question whether it was accurate or not. Later, it was also revealed that she was the ambassador from Kuwait's daughter. And some even questioned whether she was even there at the time.
You write that one of the innovations of this company was really bragging about who your clients were. That before Robert Gray, that the Washington PR and lobbying groups were very kind of circumspect about who their clients were. But when Robert Gray came along, there was a lot of kind of bragging about who clients were. And what went along with that?
Well, you know, in the old days, especially, lobbyists sort of worked behind the scenes and would only brag about their accomplishments behind closed doors. It was something that they wouldn't do openly, mainly because, you know, it would be embarrassing to the politicians who were involved to, you know, have a lobbyist saying they had manipulated them or co-opted them in any way. When Robert Gray sort of hit the scene with his own company in the 1980s, attitudes had changed. You know, Reagan had come in, and in a lot of ways, everything was the wealth and the Cadillacs and the chauffeurs and those sorts of things were brought back into the streets, and Gray started promoting himself and his clients as, you know, the top PR firm in Washington, and sort of making lobbying, he was a big push to make lobbying and public relations more of a respected profession, something that was a goal to attain in itself. You know, it was a whole change in attitude that he in a way pioneered. He would make speeches about, you know, how lobbying was respectable nowadays, and it was no longer the booze and broads and bribes that it used to be in the old days. But, you know, his own staff used to laugh at me and say, you know, Susan, that's not true. They can call them PACs and paramours and Perrier nowadays, but in many ways they operate the same way. I think the self-promotion reached its peak in the mid-80s when Michael Deaver, who had just left the White House to start his own public relations and lobbying firm, was featured on the cover of Time magazine in a limo talking on the phone. After that, there was so much criticism about just blatant influence peddling in Washington that it started to, the publicity, the self-seeking publicity started to decline a little bit.
My guest is Susan Trento, author of the new book, The Powerhouse. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Susan Trento, author of the new book, The Powerhouse, Robert Keith Gray and the Selling of Access and Influence in Washington. Your book is about influence peddling. Let me ask you to explain what influence peddling is and how you think influence peddling has escalated in Washington.
Well, in the old days, lobbyists justified their existence by saying that their role was to provide information that wasn't really available to anybody but them, because they represented the corn industry or the banking industry, or, you know, you could just name anything. They were the experts, and so they would go to Congress and provide them with information. That was the so-called good lobbyist. You know, technology and governments changed so much, especially starting in the 1970s, where the need for that sort of information no longer exists. Congress has enormous staffs. They've set up, you know, the General Accounting Office, the Library of Congress, the Office of Technology Assistance. They have available to them whatever information they need without having to go through a lobbyist to receive that. So nowadays, what you see more and more of are people who just trade on their access and friendships, people who do not have any expertise, any educational business backgrounds in the areas that they are representing. That what they're selling is their friendship and access to people that they've gained by, you know, doing them favors, contributing to them, befriending them and are working with them and turning around and then lobbying them. That's what influence peddling is, and that's what's going on more and more in Washington today.
I guess this is where the revolving door comes in, where people who were high-placed in government end up becoming lobbyists or public relations experts with the idea that they know the people in power.
Right, and, you know, even in the you know, there's been a lot of talk about and a lot of coverage, and especially I think South Carolina and Arizona, on, you know, lobbying corruption at the state capitol. But even in the state capitals, you don't even see the sort of revolving door that you do in Washington.
In examples where people who were high placed in a presidential administration became lobbyists or public relations experts, how effective do you think they've been in influencing government in their role in public relations or lobbying because of their former relationships with those people in power?
Well,
how well does this actually work in practice?
Well, in practice, it works well as far as obtaining access. You know, it's basically human nature. You know, if you've got 400 phone calls to return, you call first the people you know, the people you're familiar with. You know, maybe you'll call your friends, that sort of thing. You know, one lobbyist told me, hey, they don't just throw their phone messages in the air and, you know, grab whichever ones fall on their desk to return their calls.
What do you think the price of the new kind of lobbyist and public relations expert, what do you think the price is for the American public?
I think the biggest problem is that the average American doesn't have the resources to buy into the system. You know, they can't afford to pay somebody $400 or $500 an hour. And in a democracy, you know, that is, it's our government. It's not who you can pay for. You know, one lobbyist told me he compared Washington like a casino, say, like in Atlantic City, and said, well, you know, of course, only the high rollers get all the attention. And the American public, the average American, was just the nickel slot person, you know, that they sort of put off to the side. Then he sat back in his chair and he laughed and he said, but, you know, it's true, isn't it? You know, somebody only making $40,000 a year doesn't really have much at stake anyway.
One of the real paradoxes in your book is when the company that you write about takes on communist Angola as a client. And so here's a capitalist company taking on a communist country because they're going to make money.
Right.
It's quite a paradox.
It is. It is, and it was also, at the time, very controversial because the firm had been so closely aligned with the Reagan administration, who had been so vocally opposed to the communist government in Angola and was supporting, you know, UNITA and the opposition parties.
Have prices escalated now that we have these, like, super lobbyists and super PR companies?
It's a lot of money being made. You know, the accounts have gone from, like, maybe $15,000 a year to $50,000 just for retainer, and then you bill above that. You bill, you know, your hours, the secretary's hours, just like a law firm would, you know, whether they Xerox something for you. Newsweek had an article in last January that said having lunch with Robert Gray might cost you $1,000 with all the expenses of the limousine, the secretaries, you know, and everything by the hour.
Susan Trento is the author of the new book, The Powerhouse. Here's a footnote to our interview. In a footnote in her book, Trento writes about the alleged affair between George Bush and Jennifer Fitzgerald. Trento quotes a 1986 interview with Louis Fields, the late ambassador to the disarmament talks in Geneva. He said it became clear to him that Bush and Fitzgerald were romantically involved when Fields had to make arrangements for Bush and Fitzgerald to stay in adjoining rooms in a guest house in Switzerland. The footnote made news and got much more attention than Trento's book did. I asked her how she felt about that.
I have mixed feelings because, you know, I didn't want my book to get lost in a controversy like this that was really sort of insignificant to my book, but I'm not critical of the reporters who followed up and done things on it because, you know, I think family values and those sorts of things have been made an issue, and that everything regarding the president and or the Democratic candidate have to be pursued.
Journalist Susan Trento, this is Fresh Air.